thank you so much for the interview. Welcome to Banal of America Audio. Happy holidays.
Out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
Ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America!
Last year, we had a very special guest on for the holiday episode, and I want to do the same thing again this year.
Let's do it then. All right. Festivus is back!
And as I said, it's the holiday season, so I'm thrilled to bring him back here for the 3rd, the 4th, the 5th,
the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, the 10th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Don't bother me with the facts my mind's made up, but the public doesn't know. I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation's too much trouble, and nobody'll know the difference anyway.
Well, you can always lay claim to the fact that I think you're the only person in all of ufology that has his own holiday special. So, you know, that get that going.
Yeah, you're right about that.
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special, featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of Banal of America Audio, a historic installment of the program, in fact. On December 11th, 2005, I sat down with this guest, and we presented a conversation for the BOA Audio listeners as sort of a quasi Christmas gift, a holiday special, if you will, and we had so much fun, and it was so well received that we did it again the next year, and then we did it again the next year, and it kept going and going, and this year, I'm proud to welcome you folks to the 10th annual BOA Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman. It's an epic, epic edition of the program. Very, very excited about it, of course. Folks, you've been listening to this guy on the show for the last 10 years. You know his background, but for the newcomers in the audience, the books are, of course, Crash at Corona, Top Secret Magic, Captured, Science Was Wrong, and the one I most highly recommend, the fantastic Flying Saucers and Science. Just an absolutely tremendous book and the perfect Christmas gift for your nasty, noisy, negativist uncle that gives you crap about UFOs. Give him Flying Saucers and Science and quiet him down for New Year's. And so with all that said, it's just an absolute thrill. I said before we started the program, I was talking to him. I'm still nervous after all these years, so I guess I'm doing something right. I don't know. But I'm looking forward to it quite a bit, and I've been looking forward to it actually for the last year and gearing up into the last few days, getting more and more excited about this conversation. Welcome back to the show, Stan. Happy holidays.
Delighted to be here on this. Well, it's a lovely day here. It's about freezing, no snow. Who can complain?
That's about the best you can ask for, though. So yeah, I'll take that. Now it's been an eventful year for you, and you know, I'd be remiss if we did not talk first about the heart attack this summer. You know, you had me scared there, man. I'm glad you pulled through it. Sounds like you're doing really well. Sounds like you're back on your feet. But you know, give folks a little background on this. Give them an update on what went down this summer.
Well, okay, on June 27th. As I was approaching my 80th birthday, the end of the next month, I thought, gee, I'll make it to 80 without spending overnight in a hospital.
Hmm.
That's pretty special from talking to other people.
Yeah, that was one of your calling cards.
And so I had a heart attack and went to the hospital, and my daughter took me. She had just arrived. Hi, Melissa. How about taking me to the hospital? No, which is close. Then I got switched down to the cardiac center in St. John, New Brunswick. We have one center for the whole province. And it was dull. It was boring. I wasn't in pain. Yeah, you had a heart attack. You got to go down for a dye test, but it's the weekend. And so, okay, they took me in the ambulance. That's not a great fun ride, but it's 65 miles. And we have a great medical plan here in Canada, so it didn't even cost me a dime.
Nice.
Kind of nice. And down there, they did the dye test, and they put in two stents, these tiny little springs. They found that two arteries were blocked, and they inserted, and I didn't have a good seat for the performance, but they were looking at a screen, and you know, they do them about 15 a day down there. I was in a hospital for a couple more days, and so after a week out of circulation, I came back, and I thought, gee, now I get caught up. I didn't have my computer with me or anything, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then I got a worse thing happened. I'll call it a Hurricane Arthur. Changed its direction and hit Fredericton, where I live.
Oh, wow.
And it knocked down 4,000 trees in the Fredericton area.
Oh, God.
And we lost power, and we lost phone service, and we lost the internet, and what a pain. And we had to throw out a whole bunch of food, because, you know, after 3 days or so, they say you better throw it out.
Yeah.
It was a whole week, which is quite remarkable. So that was more of a pain in the neck.
I was just going to say, I don't know what to say. You're saying that the power going out and everything was worse than the heart attack. So you're a warrior, well, man. You're a warrior.
I'd like to get caught up, and I was, you know, without the internet and without the telephone. And, you know, so that was a pain. Interesting way to start the time period anyway. And, of course, I missed the MUFON conference in New Jersey, my home state.
Oh.
I missed that. I was supposed to give a lecture. And I also missed the
Roswell, right?
Roswell event happened before MUFON, actually. And the doctor said no. I was in the hospital, actually, so I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
But I am going this year to Roswell, and I'm not finalized on MUFON, but I think I will. And I'm traveling, within a couple months, I had done several lectures, and I put myself to the real test. I drove over 400 miles to Leominster in Massachusetts for MUFON conference, and, drove both ways, and, not, you know, there was a little time period in between.
I should hope so,
the
yeah.
conference. But, but that was the test. If I could do that, then I guess I can manage. And so, no pain, a little less energy. I think the medication probably helps in that regard, frankly.
Mm. Well,
I'm going strong,
nice.
And I have... Not expecting another one, he says. Of course, I didn't expect the first one.
Yeah. Well, I gotta give you some grief because I heard you on Coast to Coast, and you said that when you first started feeling the heart attack, you thought it was because you've been going to the gym, and then nothing made me feel worse about myself than hearing this. You're 8 years old. What are you going to the gym for?
6 months earlier, I had thought, yeah, I'm in lousy shape. We'd been spending a lot of time going back and forth to Maine. My son had died, and my brother-in-law's in trouble over there, and so spent a lot of time sitting in the car and not exercising, not walking as much as I used to, and I thought, well, let's try out this gym thing. And I hadn't realized all these zillion different machines that they have at the gyms. You know, you gradually increase the load and so forth. So I was probably in the best shape I'd been in for 10 years when the heart attack happened. Now, I'm not blaming the gym, but my doctor said, no, you cannot go back to the gym. So walking is okay, and I did a walk today, walked for 30 minutes at the local University of New Brunswick gym. For anybody who wonders about Fredericton, New Brunswick, it's the capital of the province.
Nice.
It's the home of the University of New Brunswick, the oldest English language university in Canada. Great place, a mile and a half from the house. Nice to have a good library close by.
Now, the other big thing that happened this year, you probably don't think it was as big a thing, but I thought it was spectacular. We talked about it when we set up the interview, but I want to talk more about it. I want you to tell the folks about this, how this all came together, and share your story, because it was so fun to hear you talk about it originally. This Bon Jovi pasta sauce commercial.
Oh, yes. That was fun. It's on YouTube.
There'll be links all over for folks to get to check it out. from here?
Well, it was kind of one of these things. I was supposed to go to Pittsburgh for an interview about UFOs, of course. And a couple of weeks before, hey, Stan, how about doing a commercial? A commercial? Yeah, well, we're going to be filming around that time and for Bon Jovi pasta sauce. You know, Bon Jovi the musician. I didn't, I'm not a fan one way or another. I don't know, but, but it sounded like fun. And I had lived in Pittsburgh. And so that was a, you know, let's look at the old homestead, so to speak. And, why not do the commercial? I had a couple surprises. Pittsburgh has cleaned its act up a lot. It's a big IT town, not a dirty steel town anymore. Truth. But it was an adventure because when I got to the airport, nobody there to pick me up. Guy was supposed to pick me up. I went on PA system paging him. No luck. So I waited half an hour, and I knew where I was supposed to stay. So, okay, I'll take a taxi, not that far. I get there. Oh, we don't have a reservation for you. What? Now what do I do? But they did have room. So, okay. And finally, late that evening, a guy contacts me, and okay, he'll pick me up in the morning. Well, okay, I was beginning to wonder that, you know, maybe this was a ghost appearance or something. At least I had the air ticket, and I hope I wasn't going to get stuck with the hotel bill.
Yeah.
And so they take me, they surprise me. We looked around Pittsburgh, and then they take me to a little suburb I'd never heard of, and we're driving on this street with beautiful homes on it. And the studio that these people were using was in one of those homes and in the garage.
Nice. Yeah.
That was a surprise. What are they doing commercial business out here in a residential neighborhood, you know? And so we did it, and it was fun. And it took half a dozen takes because it was a 30-second commercial.
Hmm.
And what they were doing was, which my role was to say, we talked to nuclear physicist, ufologist Stanton Friedman, and let's see which style of sauce he prefers.
Right.
And they asked me the question, and my line was real big line, all of them. You know, which do you prefer?
Yeah.
And so it was fun. I did it. I've had a lot of commentary about it since, because apparently a lot of people have seen it. I haven't seen it live on television, but.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen it on TV yet either. I hope they should start running it. I don't know what.
I don't know.
They spent all the money making it.
Well, it wasn't that much money.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important study from an undisclosed classified underground facility.
We're with best-selling author, paranormal researcher, and nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman to ask which is his favorite flavor of Bon Jovi brand pasta sauce. The marinara, the garden style, or the arrabbiata?
All of them.
There you have it, Bon Jovi brand pasta sauces, the preferred pasta sauce of paranormal researchers and nuclear physicists everywhere. Taste the tradition.
Now, tell me, you got to relate this story because it's so funny to me. When you told me this story originally, the stage mom, you ran into some trouble with a stage mom after the commercial came out,
oh,
right?
Boy, yes. Weeks later, I get a call from a woman who was angry at me. I don't know what you did, but you fouled things up for my daughter. She was going to win a prize for doing the best commercial. I said, wait a minute, what are you talking about? Well, you know, there was a competition on that, a contest of some kind. No, I didn't know that. And she did a commercial, and the last 2 days of the competition, excuse me, there are a whole bunch of votes for you. And I want to know what you did to cheat my daughter out of this. You know, what are we talking about here? I didn't do anything. As if I had spent the previous 2 days calling people and going on the internet and telling everybody vote for me.
Right, right, right. Just sitting there voting for yourself all day.
Yeah, and so I I told her, look, I didn't do anything like that. Let me check a little further. And I think she was satisfied. But although she did tell them, she complained to them, too.
Oh, boy.
People who did it. And she did tell them that there's no such thing as a nuclear physicist. And
what?
That was one of those, where'd that one come from?
Yeah, that's just weird. Oh,
well,
my God.
Look, there was another strange aspect to that trip. I mean, the life of an advertising man coming home from Pittsburgh.
Mm.
It takes three flights to get there from Fredericton. It's only a third of the way across the country. It took three flights. Pittsburgh to Washington, Washington to Montreal, Montreal to Fredericton.
Mm.
Well, pain in the neck. Why not get exercise at the airport? Well, the flight left Pittsburgh a bit late, and I did dash over to the other terminal at Dulles, and okay, we made it. And get on the plane, and we start to leave. I got plenty of time. I'll make my connection. And then on the PA system, well, we've had a little problem. The tug got caught up in the landing gear with a strap, and we need to get a knife to cut it. And what? Hey, where does that come from?
Yeah, you don't want to hear that.
Okay, we sit there and and apparently they've eventually found a knife. We go back to the terminal and getting ready to leave, and they come on the PA system saying, oh, we have to remove a passenger from the plane. Well, okay, they don't say why. I know some people probably think I'm making this up, but I'm not, and it wasn't fun. Anyway, a guy comes from the front of the plane.
And it wasn't you. That was my first question when you said,
well,
I was afraid that was
going to... Yeah, I'm wondering, what is this all about? And he goes right by me to the back of the plane, and then he heads back to the front again without anybody. And, okay, we wait a little while. He comes back out again. He goes to the back. This time he has a woman with him with a headscarf on, which may or may not mean anything. I have no idea. And he takes her back to the front. She seems to go willingly. I mean, he's not dragging her. And then they come on the air saying, well, it's going to take us a while to find her luggage, which is down in the
guts of the plane,
airplane, So, okay, we wait another 10 or 15 minutes or so. We're finally ready to leave, and they say, we're going to have to park a little while alongside the runway until we get air traffic control clearance to leave.
Oh, God.
And so we do that, and by now I know we're going to be late, but of course I didn't know how late the connecting flight would be. And I finally get to Montreal, and I run all the way across the terminal because it's a United flight, and they're at one end, and Air Canada's at the other end. Fortunately, I didn't have any checked luggage. And I go all the way, and they get me through quickly. You got to go through customs and, immigration and junk. Show your passport. Everything went fine until I get up to the desk to get my boarding pass. Sorry, the plane's all buttoned up. Too late. Now what? There's no United person around. So I go upstairs, call a number that they give me, and the gal works hard. Well, I can get you out at 3 o'clock tomorrow. This is about 9 in the evening, you understand. And I had places to go, and so I give her my special number because I'm a frequent flyer, elite frequent flyer for Air Canada, and I say, you call them on this number. She said, I'm going to have to wait 20 minutes to get back to these people. I said, well, use this number and my frequent flyer number, and you won't have to wait long. And she did, worked her magic, and used my number and stuff, and they got me on the 8 o'clock flight. Now what do I do about a hotel? Well, I can't do anything about that. She's on the phone. No United people around? No, that was the last flight, and you understand? And so I trundle off to two hotels. One was full. The second one, well, we can get you in across the street.
Oh, God.
And so I stay there, and I go home the next morning. Air Canada was on time. And I write out a five-page, I had to put the receipts and all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Fax it to them, and I don't hear anything for 3 months. And, you know, this is United Airlines. What kind of deal is this, you know? So it's really, I'm still waiting to hear.
Oh, God.
But it's aggravating. You know what I mean? It's a trip from hell, as somebody once said.
It's amazing. I like how you travel so much. You have an elite phone number that you can call to get to bypass the plebes.
That makes a difference, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Anyway, the excitement of a traveling man.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing. This has been your life for 50 years, traveling around talking about this stuff.
Oh, I gave my first lecture in 1967, so what's that,
47 years.
Pretty close. And, you know, I gave several more lectures, and I'm scheduled. Anybody can go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, and see my schedule, and go in some places I've never been, and I'll be going to England, and the possibility of tacking on to Denmark and Norway, and I've never spoken there.
Nice.
So. You know, life goes on, and it's good, and all
right.
Those sorts of things.
That's right.
Now, it will be interesting to see. I'm pushing, as you know, my big aggravation is the people who say the MJ-12 documents are all fraudulent.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, you know, all but three, and they're the ones that matter. So, you know, just the fact that most people aren't 7 feet tall doesn't mean there aren't 7-footers around.
Right, exactly.
And I've hit all the arguments that people are making, and they're still making noises. Everybody but Friedman knows that the documents are fraudulent. So my next column in the MUFON Journal will list, I don't know, I think 11 specific examples of arguments that sound good until you check the evidence.
Right. Well, you've been battling these folks for years. I wanted to just circle back a little bit to the traveling part. So I wanted to ask you, did you ever have like a peak? What was your peak year as far as traveling goes, where you hit like a ton of stuff? I know where you talked about before where you did like a tour where you traveled all over the place.
Well, my longest single tour was, let's see, 25 lectures in 35 days in 15 states. And that's work.
Hmm.
I mean, I saw spring come in three different parts of the country. And as I tell people, you got to have a cast iron stomach and a cast iron throat. Well, you know, you're on the go.
Yeah.
You're not always going big city to big city. You got to drive. You got to rent a car. You know, it's work. Well, I mention this because I've had people say, oh, you're so lucky. You know, I've given 700 lectures in 50 states, 10 provinces, and 18 other countries. You get to travel so much. Well, it's work.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where's the fun? There's no time off in there.
Right, because you're in town for like a, let's say you go to D.C. for a thing. You may not even have time. You know, people are like, oh, you get to go to Washington. You don't really get to go look around or anything. You don't really get to go, like, visit the St. Louis Arch or something like that unless you take the time specifically to do it.
Yeah, I mean, even when I'm overseas. Now, there was one exception this past year, earlier in the year, in Brazil. There's an incredible waterfall. It's one of the world's largest. And the way the conference was set up, several of us, Travis Walton, Don Schmidt, and I, had time to go out to the waterfalls. And it was spectacular.
Nice.
Huge. And so it was so lucky because normally I wouldn't have time, but just the way the timing worked out.
Yeah.
And so that was nice. But I'm not a big sightseer around the world, unfortunately. I mean, it just usually doesn't work out that way.
Is there anything you like to do in each city, like get a meal at a different restaurant or something like that, or is it just all on the go, just do the lecturing?
Pretty much all on the go. Once in a while, you get to eat a nice meal. And I just got an invitation yesterday to give a talk in Washington, D.C. to an outfit that meets in the best French restaurant in town.
Nice.
Don't ask me to explain that. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Presuming we'll have a meal if I'm going to speak there.
Now, traditionally, we in the last like 7 years, we've been doing the listener questions. But since this is the 10th year, I really wanted to kind of go old school and just talk to you, and we'll save the listener questions for next year and bring them back then. So I didn't solicit any questions because I just, like I said, I mean, we've been doing this since December 11, 2005. So I wanted to kind of go all the way back and circle back and really sort of, like I said, go old school.
Okay.
So I was thinking about it. We talked about this. You've been looking at all this for the last 47 years. At what point over that time did you, like, in retrospect, do you feel like we were the closest to sort of breaking through this whole thing? You know, do you look back and go, oh, 85, we were so close, you know, because it's always like disclosure's right around the corner. And you've seen a lot of corners in the last 47 years. So what was the closest corner that you can recall?
Well, I mean, there was that rumor that U.S. News and World Report, one of those, had an article that President Carter was going to break the story about flying saucers, and it didn't happen.
Huh.
That was a disappointment. I don't remember ever thinking that disclosure was around the corner. I mean, I was in Washington for that big parade of speakers, and I guess congressmen have finally gotten a DVD of the presentation.
Right, right.
And I wasn't really anticipating much from that, although I will say this. You know, there were six former members of Congress who were on a panel. I guess if they were active, still congressmen, they wouldn't have gone on it.
yeah, exactly.
And I was pleased to see how by the fourth day, it was clear that they were intrigued. They started off knowing very little. Nobody had given them a real briefing. But they asked enough questions, pretty sharp people. And so I enjoyed that part of it, but I didn't expect, because I'm not one who says, we are entitled to know everything. I don't believe that. I believe there is a national security aspect to this.
Right.
Especially the technology end. And, you know, I just read something yesterday, would you believe? The farthest out technology you can imagine. All these people supposedly have been transported magically through time and space to Mars. And there's a colony there. It's sort of the Serpo story.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that little meme. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just read a new version. Alfred Weber is writing like this is all real. And
yeah. It's ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, I like evidence. It isn't enough to tell a pretty story. I mean, science fiction writers have been telling great stories for a very long time. Jules Verne, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And but they don't need to produce any evidence. Although, interestingly enough, I find I talk in my MUFON paper, which is in the proceedings of the conference, was about press coverage of UFOs, an exercise in laziness and frustration or something like that. But three science fiction writers, noted ones, are strongly anti-UFO.
Right, right.
Totally ignorant. That's Isaac Asimov, Ben Bova, and Arthur C. Clarke. And that comes as a surprise to people. They sort of link flying saucers and UFOs. I just had a note yesterday from a guy in Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying how he's very dubious. You know, why did you switch from being a scientist to being a UFO preacher? How's that? you know, wrong religion anyway, but, he mentioned apparently a famous Hungarian astronomer who long since dead, but who had said, you know, this was all fairy tales, this UFO stuff. So I came on kind of strong to the guy saying, you know, repeating my four basic rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. But the public doesn't know. I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation's too much trouble, and nobody will know the difference anyway. I'll be interested to see how he responds to that. But, well, you know, I get a little sick of this notion in the first place that most people don't believe in UFOs. And look, I put that to the test. 700 lectures, 11 hecklers, two of whom were drunk, and the audience took care of the other nine. And I come on very, very strong. And one guy asked that we pull the audience. Okay, I did. More than 90% said they thought some UFOs were alien spacecraft. That's a pretty good response on any subject, you know.
Yes.
So I spend much of my time getting rid of the myths, and I had to stress to this guy that I'm a little sneaky. I talk about five large-scale scientific studies and ask after each one how many people here have read this. And I'm lucky if I get 2% who read any of them.
Right, right, right.
People, I'm hoping that will keep some people shutting up who would otherwise blast away, but who would have to admit, well, no, I haven't looked at any of those studies, of course. So, you know, I don't like giving a public platform to somebody who hasn't done his homework.
Unfortunately, the media does, though. That's the problem.
Well, yes.
You're always, it seems like you're, you know, thank God you're tirelessly going after these guys and sort of breaking down their ridiculous arguments. It's crazy. But the thing about people believing in UFOs, they definitely think there seems to have been like a psychological shift in the public where I think they do believe in UFOs, but they, you know, they accept it, but they dismiss it at the same time. They don't want to deal with it. They can't deal with it. I think, like, if you look, like, it's like back in the day, if someone was like, oh, you believe in aliens, that would be like an insult. And I think we're getting closer and closer to a time when the guy who says that is the moron.
Well, that's right. And one thing that I keep hearing over and over again, surely we're not the only ones in this vast universe. And I think part of that is the Kepler findings, that there are planets all over the darn place.
Right.
You know, there were a lot of people who said there weren't any other solar systems not too many years ago. You know, you go back to the 20s, there was only one galaxy. Big argument in astronomy. And then Hubble got special data which shows, oh, yeah, gee whiz, there are lots of galaxies out there, you know.
Yeah.
But today, I think most people, you know, SETI gets a lot of publicity. Totally unwilling to look at the UFO evidence. I suppose because if aliens are coming here, who needs to listen for radio signals? And I tell people SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, and it's worth a good laugh. And it is, because it assumes that aliens are stuck at a technological level just like us.
Right.
So we're going to be able to sort out their signals and interpret them. You know, you have to say, AM or FM, fellas. well, you know, it's kind of crazy. People forget, if they ever knew, I guess, that the first long-distance radio signal on this planet, thanks to Mr. Marconi, to Newfoundland, mind you, was 1901. That's not very long ago. The planet's been around for 4 billion years, 4.5, and you think that everybody is no more advanced than we are? I'm constantly marveling on how much we've learned. You know, go back to 1890. No, we didn't know anything about neutrons, gamma rays, X-rays, photons, fission, fusion, flight, DNA, radio, you know.
Yeah.
We're Johnny come latelys by any scheme of measuring. And I still get some people who want to say, well, if they're coming here, why don't they land on the White House lawn? And you try to get people, hey, look at this planet we're on. What's the major activity here? It's military.
Right.
You know, we're not a friendly people. Our pilots don't wave at saucers. We try to shoot them down. Remember back in 52? Shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so, which is one of those silly things. If you think about that, you know, I've talked to 7 people who tell me of situations that occurred at the military base at which they were stationed where pilots went up and never came back. But all of them, it sounds like it was self-defense. I'm the ones where I can pin them.
Yeah.
Does anybody expect aliens to treat us as equals?
Of Of course, people expect that. That's the problem, really. At the end of the day, they think that we should be on par with everything. I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know. You know, as a human, maybe I shouldn't sell out the race as a species, but I don't know.
We've come to a very special place in our understanding of the universe, and that we have figured out that it's nuclear fusion that produces almost all the energy, certainly in all the stars. And anybody who thinks about it, and I don't mean the SETI people, I mean engineers and so forth, realizes that you can use nuclear fusion for a propulsion system. And if you do that, it's as much advanced over chemical rockets as an H-bomb is over a 10-ton blockbuster. And we don't want to think about that, I guess. What would you say about this planet? It's a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. What I just read last night, I heard that 100 kids got killed in Africa.
Yeah, there was some kind of terrorist thing, yeah.
Yeah, the Taliban, I don't know whether it was Africa or not.
Yeah, it's a mess.
They go into a school and they start shooting kids.
Well, that's happening here in America. It's scary, scary altogether.
Yeah.
You know, it's scary altogether.
So, you look at us and you say, why would anybody want to be friendly with us? We'd want to grab their vehicle, first thing we'd do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, how much do we have to pay to get you to help us build more of these, you know?
Well, it's interesting, too. I was thinking about it going into this conversation that it's so frustrating because we really don't have any answers to a lot of these big UFO questions, like why don't they come here? I mean, why do they come here? You know, where are they from? How are they getting here? But when you look at it, I guess we can definitely say the one question that we know the answer to is that they don't want us to know about them, and they don't want us to interact with them as much as possible. Like, they want to control the interaction, if there is any, and they certainly don't want us to know more about them.
Well, can you blame them?
No, not at all. But
do we act like a friendly species? We kill our, I mean, you know, how many kids died of starvation yesterday? And the day before, and the day before that, and the day before that. And yet we will spend $1 trillion on things military this year.
Well, it's scary, because I talked to a friend of mine. He's a friend of mine's father. He's an MIT professor, actually, and he works with the Kepler data. We'll have to talk sometime off the air more about it. But I asked him about UFOs and aliens and all that, and he seemed kind of, in a way, mirrors what you're saying, but on an even more darker level, because he seemed to really be pessimistic that you know, a technologically advanced species could even get it together to be traveling around like that. Like looking at just our race. Maybe he's pessimistic about the human race, but still, it's like, you know, can we ever really even get it together to become aliens to some other race, or are we going to blow ourselves up before that happens?
Well, the interesting question, if we could go to the galactic archives, is what percentage of the civilizations that finally get to the point where they know how their sun operates, you know, the primary source of energy in all solar systems is clearly their star. How many of those that get to that point manage to stay healthy? That is, you know, not destroy themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, people don't realize how close we came, if you look at the history of the Cold War. We were lucky to get through that. And they also don't realize we exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. Not two on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Well, there were two there. But, I mean, 2,000 other ones. Demonstration, testing, et cetera. And from the big countries to the small one. I mean, Korea is an example.
Hmm.
It is truly remarkable that we and the Russians didn't get into a war. And I'll never forget, I'd love to follow this up sometime, heard a Russian general on a radio program saying that they had assassinated Stalin in 53. And it was one of those things that he was going to go to war. And the Russians lost more than 20 million people in the war.
Yeah.
And I took a trip, my wife and I took a tour of the countries, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, the Baltic countries, and Russia. And when you figure, how did the Russians stand off the Germans in 42? They lost over 1 million people there. But if they hadn't delayed the Germans, they'd have been already on the Western Front when we attacked.
Yeah.
It might have gone the other way. And, you know, especially if we hadn't broken the codes. And, you know, there's another area that really irks me, that people don't understand how much classified work has gone on. They think R&D is what goes on at universities and no place else. You know, and just to name a couple, the Ultra Project, the breaking of the German codes, and then eventually the Japanese codes as well. That was extraordinarily important for winning the war, because it's nice to know where the other guy's ships are going, where his submarines are going, where his airplanes are going. I mean, it gives you a real leg up. You know, it may not give you another bullet, but the element of surprise gets taken away, and that's very useful.
Yeah.
And what people don't realize, the fact that we had broken the codes wasn't made public until 25 years after the war. We can't keep secrets. There were 12,000 people at Bletchley Park in England involved in that. Not one word in public. Of course we can keep secrets.
Well, I think people should realize that just by the whole Snowden thing and the spying and all the revelations that came out of that. I mean, I'm sure you would think that would change the public perception in a way about whether the government can keep secrets or not, because it's like...
Yeah, but not the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who insist that the government can't keep secrets, you see.
Hmm.
I've told you before that dear old Dr. Tyson said the proof that the government can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia, which is one of those lines that will forever be etched in history as utterly absurd. Operation Solarium is another example, which most people have never heard of.
Yeah, I've never heard of this.
In 1953, the new President Eisenhower was very much concerned about whether we were going to keep just spending more money on arms in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Berlin Wall and the
right, it was escalating.
Stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so he set up three separate teams of people in great secrecy whose job it was to look at one of the three possibilities for containment. And it was a major effort. It was done in complete secrecy. They had a cover story what these guys were doing. And they finally worked out a way to be other than just more arms and more arms to threaten each other. And its very existence wasn't made public until the late 80s, 25 years later again.
Wow.
And it was a major effort. I mean, we're talking about dozens of big people, expensive people involved in this. You know, the atomic bomb project, of course, was a major effort. But there have been numerous other large-scale programs spending tons of money, which were not done in academia. And people just don't seem to understand this.
Mm.
That governments can keep secrets. Now, keeping a secret doesn't mean that everybody in government knows, them and us.
You know, right, right.
If you're in government or not, and if you're in government, you know what's going on. During the breaking of the Ultra Code, the Enigma machine, you know, all that whole story, there were four people who knew what was going on. It was very compartmentalized.
Yeah.
Loads of people working on it. Like I say, 12,000 at Bletchley Park who had to interpret and decode and transcribe and quietly distribute. Because the key thing was nobody could find out that we'd broken the code or the Germans would change it.
Right, right, right.
And that would be disastrous. And so four guys knew what was going on. So it's not that you tell everybody and hope nobody talks, is you tell almost nobody.
Exactly.
And, you know, well, the spy, first spy satellite, Corona spy satellite. Corona as in Corona, New Mexico. Which
That's right, yeah.
The Roswell crash occurred.
Like a tribute.
Yeah. And, you know, the first spy satellite, do you realize that we had 12 that didn't work? 12 launches that were unsuccessful in secret.
Mm.
The 13th one worked, but it got them more data about what was going on in the Soviet Union than all of the U-2 flights that occurred before that.
Wow.
One satellite did that. And we kept launching them. And it was extraordinarily important because we discovered that the Russians didn't have a whole bunch of missile launch sites, which we were worried about.
Yeah.
You know, and we underestimated the Russians. A lot of people don't realize that the guy who headed the Manhattan Project, General Groves, in 48 said it would take the Russians 8 years to get to their first atomic bomb explosion.
Uh-huh.
It happened in 49, 1 year later.
Oh, wow.
You know, dumb peasants. The most scary thing I've ever seen in an archive were some minutes of National Security Council meetings where it was announced in, like, 1951 that the Russians had made more progress in the development of nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them because they considered, well, the Russians don't have any big airplanes to drop bombs on us, so even if they get an atomic bomb, so what? They can't reach us. Well, they had kept the B-29 that was there on some kind of a mission, and they duplicated it many times over. Call it back engineering, call it whatever you want. And so we were caught with our pants down. Do you remember they had people whose job it was to stand on tall buildings and keep their eyes open for Russian airplanes?
No, that's a little before my time.
Well, that was before we had a radar system around. What do you need radar for? There's nothing to worry about. Yeah, we will. Hey, I just saw an airplane. What kind is it? Well, I don't know. Let's check with Joe. Well, you know, and then we put in the dew line. We did all kinds of other things. But we were not in good shape because of ignorance and arrogance. And the ignorance and arrogance is a perfect example of what's wrong with the astronomical community's notion about flying saucers. Well, they're interested in what's going on in the universe out there. Of course they would know about it. And if aliens were coming, they'd want to talk to them. You know, that's the attitude. And nobody could keep any secrets from us.
Yeah.
And also, you can't get here from there. And that really bugs me.
I know.
Because it's nonsense. You know, the smallest thing you can use for electronics is a vacuum tube, right?
It's just,
sorry.
Yeah. It's like people don't want to use their imagination. They'd rather just be surprised by things. It's sad. It's really it's sad.
Hey kids. I heard on the news that an airline pilot spotted Santa's sled on its way in from New York.
Oh.
You serious, Clark?
It's the Banal of America Audio Holiday Special featuring Stanton Friedman.
Happy holidays!
It's the one night of the year when we all act a little nicer, we smile a little easier, we share a little more. For a couple of hours out of the whole year, we are the people that we always hoped we would be.